Good afternoon. You may have noticed that I am not Julie Wise Oreck. I'm Chuck Cohen. I'm from the Indianapolis Jewish Federation, and I'm standing in for Julie, who had a conflict that she couldn't avoid. So you got me instead. I'm pleased to present you with three experts who have their fingers on the pulse of philanthropy to help you put your Federation ahead of the curve. Things that are going on, the Ice Bucket Challenge, Giving Tuesday, crowdfunding, text to give, colorful wristbands for your cause. Sometimes it's hard to tell what's a trend and that has staying power and what's just a flash in the pan. But a right or wrong choice can mean the difference between a smart investment and a costly one. As community stewards, Federation leaders need to be on top of the latest trends, but with a sharp enough eye to discern a true wave of the future from a passing craze, especially when it comes to giving. So today we're going to hear from three people. Joelle Asaro-Berman is a program director of Amplifier, which is at the forefront of the Natan Fund's value-driven given circles movement. We'll hear more about that because I have no idea what a values-driven circles movement is. You were hiding. Emily Sokash, Executive Director of the Jewish Federation of Pinellas and Pasco Counties and the Tampa Orlando Pinellas Jewish Foundation. That's a mouthful. It's TOP. And is witnessing a surge in the popularity of donor-advised funds. We'd like to thank the TOP Jewish Foundation for sponsoring this session. As Chief Investment Officer and Managing Director of Investments at Impact Assets, Fran Siegel specializes in impact investing, investing in organizations that generate social and environmental change as well as financial returns. So she explains impact investing. This is in the script, so I have to say this. How are you doing in the GA app game? I am not playing. I will openly admit that. I'm not playing. I didn't even load the app. But hopefully some of you are, because if you're feeling behind, you can earn points by taking the survey after each session or post photos in the app with new friends. Last night we were at dinner with my group from Indianapolis, and one person took a picture of the group. And another person was angry because they were going to be able to post and get all the points in the app. So they made them share the photo so they could both get points in the app. You can also go chat with exhibitors. Extra points for doing the Fed Central demo. Remember, you've got to be at the closing ceremony, closing plenary tomorrow afternoon to win that trip to Israel. Good luck. You must be present to win. I'll now turn the session over to our moderator, Gail Gordon, Senior Endowment Director at JFNA. Gail.
Hi. You can hear me okay, right? In 2013, Connected to Give, a collaborative project of the Jewish Federations and other philanthropies, published the first of a series of reports that were intended to give a realistic depiction of the philanthropic landscape. Based on data from the 2013 National Study of American Jewish Giving, the reports found that, and a lot of you will be familiar with this, but I'm refreshing your memory. Most American Jews are charitable givers. Most Jews who make charitable contributions give to both Jewish and non-Jewish organizations. Engagement with Jewish community is a paramount driver of Jewish charitable giving and even drives giving to non-Jewish organizations. While age is not a driving factor in the incidence and amount of charitable giving overall, younger Jews clearly are less likely to give to Jewish organizations. The original proponents of Connected to Give hoped that the project would inform and empower grantmakers and nonprofits to understand, anticipate, and respond to giving trends for the causes they support, create more effective donor marketing, education, and stewardship strategies, reshape the language and messages they use to engage prospective donors and mobilize existing ones, take concrete steps to improve donor trust and commitment, and offer the best products and services for their stakeholders as called upon by Jewish tradition. If you want to advance that agenda in your communities, then you are in the right place. Our presenters will speak on three exciting philanthropic trends, which Chuck just mentioned to you, and share critical information about how you can use them to engage and mobilize your donors. If you want to do this intelligently, I encourage you to listen for cues on how to weigh the rewards that the trends promise against other initiatives that may compete for human and financial resources in your communities. Joelle will open the program. Joelle Asara-Berman is first up. She's program director, as Chuck said, of Amplifier, a new initiative of the Natan Fund. You will hear more about that from her. She's worked in the Jewish nonprofit space for more than 10 years, cultivating the brands and communication strategies of the Foundation for Jewish Camp and Taglit Birthright Israel. She is known to start infectious dance parties, which she says are a great tool for community building, and I'm hoping that they'll put that on the program for next year's GA. Joelle's going to enlighten us about empowered philanthropy through giving circles. In giving circles, donors pool their charitable contributions and make decisions collectively as a group about the organizations and projects that they will support. And if you are familiar with Jewish Women's Foundations, then you already know a bit about what the power of giving circles is. Okay, Joelle.
We don't have to wait till next year for the dance party. Can make that happen now. Hi, everyone. It's nice to see all of you here. How's the GA? So I want to start here. On July 19th this past summer, something pretty awesome happened to me. I was huddled around my dining room table in Brooklyn, my tiny Brooklyn apartment, with seven of my closest friends. Some of these people I've known for the better part of 15 years, thank you Jewish Summer Camp, and here we are having a conversation that we have never had before. And that conversation is, how can we change the world together? How can we pool our financial assets, our expertise, our education, our passions, our networks? How can we take all this and make serious change in our Brooklyn community? This was the first meeting of my giving circle. And before this meeting, I could have never dreamed of calling myself a philanthropist. I've worked in this community a long time, and I know what a philanthropist looks like. Usually, they're older than me, they have much deeper pockets than I do. But thanks to this giving circle experience, others like me around the world can actually call themselves empowered philanthropists. I'm going to talk a little bit more about that term in a moment, but just show of hands, who knows what giving circles are? That's a lot of people. Why did you even come? Okay, great. So, fantastic. So just so we're all on the same page about what that is. A giving circle is a group of people who come together, friends, families, neighbors, colleagues, pool their charitable donations, and then decide together how they're going to give them away. And a Jewish giving circle is a group of people, and it doesn't matter who you are or where you give, but a Jewish giving circle is informed and guided by Jewish values and wisdoms and sensibilities. Amplifier is a global movement of Jewish giving circles, and I'll talk a little bit more about how Amplifier came to be shortly. But before I move on, I want to talk a little bit more about what makes giving circles unique. Giving circles basically give you a space to consider deeply your values, the why and the how of why you give, how you give, what really is driving you. And then it gives you a community of peers to do that with and to bring in new perspectives and help you see the world in different ways and maybe reconsider some of the values you thought you were bringing to the table or the topics you were interested in. And then it gives you a process, and you and this group of friends moves through this process together, and you start with your values and you start with what you're passionate about, and eventually you land on concrete things to fund together. This is not about reactive giving. This is not about somebody coming up to you and saying, hey, you should give because I'm walking in this walk or racing in this race, or you should give to this, you should give to your university, you should give to this specific cause. What this is about is empowered philanthropy. This is putting you in the driver's seat and starting with what you care about and puts you in control. Because dare I say, giving circles might be the most fun and effective way that you can give away your money. Let's look a little bit more about, you know, what some giving circles out there are like. So I'm going to start with the giving circle that ultimately gave birth to Amplifier. It's called the Natan Fund. Who's heard of the Natan Fund? awesome. Natan is based in New York City. It's about 12 years old. And today it has more than 100 members who sit across 9 different grant committees and fund Jewish and Israeli innovation around the world. This year alone, they gave away $1.2 million. And they have looked around at the space and they've seen all these other giving circles popping up. Solalim is a giving circle at UJA Federation of New York. And 15 years ago, UJA looked out and saw all these donors that it could not get to give to the annual campaign. And it said, you know what? How about you come to the table to the tune of $50,000 each, and you commit to a 3-year giving cycle and be part of this giving circle, and we'll let you direct the money. And they didn't restrict where the money went. Some of it went to Federation grantees, and some of it didn't go to Federation grantees. But lo and behold, 15 years later, they've made more than 60 multi-year grants and given away more than $6 million. Many of them are now donors to the annual campaign. Many of them now sit on Federation's fundraising and allocations committees, and many of them have been honored at UJA's events time and time again. At JCF in San Francisco, they've started a giving circle called the Israel Giving Circle, and this grew out of one of their programs called their Israel Impact Grants Initiative. This was an initiative that brought a bunch of young people together to direct money, not their own, but to direct money to different initiatives happening in Israel, and part of that was taking them to Israel to visit all these grantees. And while they were on that trip, one of the participants said, hey, I really want to do this with my friends. Can you teach me how to do this with my friends? So he came back. Federation had him go out and recruit 16 people who had never been involved in Federation before. They all came to the table, and now the Federation hosts that giving circle, matches the funds that they give away, and guides this group through the process of finding really exciting and innovative Israel grantees to fund. This past year, they gave away $24,000 to 2 organizations, and now they're in their second grant cycle. And if you want to learn more about this, the amazing Siggy Rubinson at JCF of San Francisco would probably be happy to tell you more. Another giving circle that bears mentioning is JFNA's Social Venture Fund for Jewish Arab Equality and Shared Society. This is a giving circle that's been around since 2007 and to date has allocated more than $7 million to amazing peacemaking initiatives in Israel. Not only do they do the work of any giving circle, which is collaborating and deciding on how they're going to give their funds away, but they also bring all of their Israel grantees together for annual gatherings to share best practices, to train them, to make sure that they're networked and on the ground working on the same types of change. And I would be remiss if I did not mention the amazing work of the Jewish Teen Funders Network. Steph Selkin's in the room. Steph, raise your hand, please. Steph is in charge of this network that brings together more than 100 teen philanthropy programs around the country, and these happen in synagogues, camps, day schools, federations, community foundations, and they empower teens to undergo a really interesting and thoughtful leadership process, again, to allocate funds out to the community to grantees that they see fit. You need look no further than watch an amazing Ellie talk by a young woman named Juliana Rodriguez from the Rose Community Youth Foundations program. She will show you what the power of these programs are on teens. So, as I mentioned, Natan has been doing this for about 12 years, and they looked around and they saw all of these other giving circles out there, and they realized, like, wow, like, everyone's using this very similar model. You know, whether you call it a venture philanthropy fund or a women's foundation or a Sadaka collective or a teen foundation, these are all basically the same thing. They're everybody getting together, pooling their money, and deciding how they're going to give it away. So it gave birth to Amplifier. And Amplifier helps anybody start or join a Jewish giving circle. And the beauty of this model is that a giving circle can be for anyone. It doesn't matter what their age is, it doesn't matter how much money they have, it doesn't matter what they're passionate about, and really it could be used to meet any personal or organizational mission. So Amplifier offers lots of online and offline services, and I'm not gonna speak so in depth about what that is right now, and if you have a lot of questions, you can ask me after. Or just go to our website, amplifiergiving.org. But one of the things that we are doing right now that could be of interest to you is what's called our Jewish Giving Circle Incubator Program. And through this program, we've selected 38 amazing community builders around the country. For the next 8 months, they're going to be building giving circles from scratch in their communities. And I have 2 of those people in this room today because 6 federations are actually part of our cohort. And I wanted to talk a little bit more about the giving circles that they're going to be starting. So these are my amazing 6 participants. Danielle, raise your hand. And Andy in the back, raise your hand. These are two of our six participants who are participating from federations. I want to talk a little bit more about their giving circles. So Danielle in Cincinnati is going to be bringing together a handful of leaders, between 8 and 10 people, some of whom have been very involved in federation in the past and some of whom have not. And they're going to be coming to the table to the tune of $10,000 each to come together and fund Jewish innovation in Cincinnati to try to seed new, exciting, innovative, engaging programs for young Jewish adults in Cincinnati on the ground. This is going to be the fund that they create to start that. Joanne, who's unfortunately not here but lives in Portland, is starting a giving circle for women between the ages of 35 and 45 in Oregon, specifically to address the issues of health and wellness and Jewish genetic health. They've identified this as a cause in their community that they're really excited about and really want to educate people about, so she's bringing together more people to do that. Andy in Northern New Jersey is bringing together a group of leaders between the ages of 35 and 55, again to the tune of around $10,000 each, to come together and, as she says, find like the middle of the Venn diagram about what puts a fire in their bellies and what the Federation's mission is and what issue areas everybody cares about. So these are just three examples of the different types of things that people are trying around the country. We realize that this is very different from the way things usually work at federations, and it's really exciting to try it because it really has an ability to bring in people who may otherwise not be drawn to a federation's mission. So there's some things that everybody here needs to know if they're thinking of starting a giving circle in order to be successful. And the first thing is to have a really serious clarity of your mission and goals. What will define success for you in your giving circle? Is it to engage a new demographic? Is it to draw attention to a cause area that your federation or community cares about? Is it to build community among a group of stakeholders that really need to be networked and brought closer together? Whatever these are, it's important to know what they are so that you can measure success about how the giving circle is working later on. I want to make a note here. Giving circles, I will just come out and say this. Giving circles are not a good way to see a short-term return on your annual campaign. That is not what they are for. They are for a long-term investment in philanthropic education and in educating in your leadership and doing deep leadership development for your top donors. That is really what giving circles are about. And the more that we're predisposed to seeing them as a vehicle for that, the more you'll see success with them. As I mentioned, of course, before, with the example of Salim, the money will come in time. As one of our federation participants in the incubator says, it's a marathon and not a sprint. Another thing to think about is the right staff and resources for your project. Maybe not the gang at Dunder Mifflin, but you know. It's really important to think about, do you need a fundraiser on staff for this? Do you need a planner on staff for this? If your giving circle is focused more on causes in a specific research area, it's probably good to have a planning person there. If what you're trying to do is build deeper relationships with a certain subset of donors, it's probably good to have a fundraiser there, or sometimes a combination of both. It's also really important to think about what dollar amount in that giving circle pool is going to make it worth it for you to devote staff time to this. This is why you're hearing about high dollar amounts. And to this end, it's really great to bring in what we would call a match mentor, somebody in your community who's willing to match that pool of funds to make sure that the giving circle can give even more money away than they put in. It's also important to think about the sustainability of your giving circle. Is this a 3-year project? Is this a 6-year project? Is it a 10-year project? This goes back to the clarity of goals and how you'll know you've been successful when you get there. We do recommend having a giving circle on the ground for at least 3 years. By that time, the right people will have found their way to the table, and you will have evened out your processes for the whole learning process of the giving circle and your grant allocation. And lastly, it's really important to have an appetite for experimentation when you're doing a giving circle. It's really important to think of it, at least in its first couple years, as a pilot, something to learn from, something to test things with. Even if you don't get it right the first time, you can get it right eventually. Giving circles, despite this illustration, are not rocket science. They really aren't. There's a million right ways to do them. There's no single right way to do it. So there's really two ways into thinking about starting a giving circle. You can start with your audience. What demographic do you want to engage more deeply? Is it young people? Is it empty nesters? Is it women? Who is it? It might be really worth bringing them in for a giving circle to see how you can build a better relationship with them. And second of all, is to think about what issue areas your community really wants to put a spotlight on. Is it Israel? Is it health and wellness? Is it women and girls? Is it innovation? Whatever it might be, that might also be a good starting place for your giving circle. If you have any other questions about how to get your giving circle off the ground, I'm happy to share any of our free resources and to help coach you in your path to doing so. We want to help you succeed. You can reach me at any of these URLs and Twitter handles and whatnot. And hopefully after this presentation, I believe my presentation and some resources are going to be available for you on the Federation's website. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Joelle. I am a lawyer in the Plant Giving and Endowments Department at JFNA in New York, and I was behind the scenes on putting together our Israel Arab Social Venture Fund and did some of the documentation. And when we were putting this together, I took a look at the Amplifier website, and I only wish that that had been around when we were doing what we were doing. It's really good. You should take a look. Okay, so next up is Emily. And Chuck already told you that she currently serves as the executive, Emily Sokash, I'll say her full name again. She serves as the executive director of the Top Jewish Foundation. In the 3 years she's been at Top, their portfolio has grown by 30%. But that wasn't enough to contain her energy. So a little while ago, she also became the executive director of the Jewish Federation of Pinellas and Pasco Counties. Emily will speak to us about donor-advised funds. Most of you are probably familiar with them, but the quick and dirty is a donor-advised fund is established with a charitable gift that entitles the donors or people that they name to make recommendations about how the charity will invest and spend the assets in the donor-advised fund account. JFNA's annual survey of plan giving and endowments programs reported that in 2013, the Federation system held $4.7 billion in donor-advised funds. So this is a powerful vehicle. And they distributed $822 million in grants, including almost $87 million to the annual campaign. Emily will tell you about creative new ways that she and her donors are using donor-advised funds to good use. Emily.
I'm going to switch over to a handheld in a moment, but first let me take us back to the beginning here. Wow, you went pretty far. One moment. Let's see. I don't know how to go back on the clicker, so. Okay. That seems good. Well, I went too far. So thank you, everyone, for coming out. I see a nice full room. After lunchtime is a perfect time, really, to talk about donor-advised funds.
I can't promise you a dance party. Can you hear me?
You can be part of this one.
Are we on? Excellent. So I can't promise you a dance party, but what I can promise you is a very, very, very encouraging and inspiring message about donor-advised funds. So before we jump in, I will tell you a little bit about me and TOP. So about me, I have an undergraduate degree in English, and I have a master's in nonprofit management. And you may have noticed none of that involves anything related to law or taxation or finance or investments or anything like that. Donor-advised funds are accessible to all of us. So if you happen to be like me and you have a degree that did not put you into law or medicine or that, you too can become a donor-savvy, donor-advised fund expert of sorts. So let's see what happens here. I'm clicking. Okay, so I'm gonna walk back over here. So why do donors use donor-advised funds? It's not working. Can I get the pointer on this thing? One moment, please. Okay, excellent. So a lot of times we think about that if you're going to be doing anything with donor-advised funds, it's kind of inherent in the actual terminology that we use about these funds that it sounds like you do need to be an expert I assure you, you do not. You do not need to be this guy who is saying you can't handle the truth. You do not need to be her who's in the courtroom always looking snazzy. None of that. Really, what you need to understand is why donors would choose to use a donor-advised fund. So in a lot of ways, the initial description is very accurate, but in a nutshell, a donor-advised fund is like a charitable checking account. So our donors are going to put away money and make a donation, which is, pending their situation, tax-deductible to the fullest extent of the law. They're going to do that at the time that is right for them and their family. They will, at another time, decide where they want those monies to go. It could be a year from now, it could be a couple years from now, whenever they want. Donor advised funds also offer our donors privacy. Their names don't have to go out. The amounts of their donations don't have to go out. They're not listing all of the charities that they support. Now, this can be very difficult for fundraisers, right? If you're looking to figure out where does a donor put their money, this gives them a level of privacy. And also, donor advice funds are very, very easy for the donor. Okay, so that's why they're using them. The first trend that we're seeing in terms of donor advised funds, how donors are using them, is that this is really becoming a gateway to involved philanthropy. So on this chart here, we think about our most casual gift. That is, you give a couple bucks to the Girl Scout that comes to the door. Maybe you get some cookies. Maybe you don't. It's a nameless gift. You then maybe elevate it up to a federation gift or some sort of an annual campaign gift where somebody is willing to put their name on a gift. When you get to a donor-advised fund, this is really a sweet spot because a donor is now considering themselves a philanthropist, and they're becoming more and more engaged and involved with their philanthropy. They're saying, it is so important to me to give, whether it be to my federation or to my JFS or to a non-Jewish cause, it is so important for me to give that I'm going to set aside these monies because I know I'm going to give them. The other trend that I think is very, very relevant in the federation world is that donor-advised funds are being used more and more to accomplish generational goals. So we all aspire to L'Dor V'Dor. We want to pass on to our children our values. Donor-advised funds are being used in this very way. I'm seeing this a lot in my foundation, and I hear it from my colleagues as well. I have a handful of families who have set up for their adult children what I call a sandbox, a little playground where they've set aside X thousands of dollars so that their children, college age, young adults, young families, they have monies to go through the philanthropic process. So whether it's a guy talking to his grandson at a conference, whether it's a guy taking his adult son on a walk in nature, they are talking about these main elements. It's not just the values that they're passing on, but it's also the approach to philanthropy. I'm going to run through these really quickly. Older generations are using donor-advised funds to pass along the approach of doing due diligence, of finding a match for philanthropic goals and visions, of funding efforts that get to the root cause of something, of a problem, about doing good research, and also about recommending that cause to others. A donor-advised fund allows a family to pass on these approaches as well as the values that all exist behind. Now, the third trend, and I think that this is probably one that will continue to grow over time, we're seeing that donor-advised funds can be used to replace family foundations. Now, it's not right in every situation. There are mega foundations that are really, really the fine work of a family that's very philanthropic. But we also have a lot of community-level family foundations that have, it's hard to say, but they have a modest level of assets in them. And it may not make sense for that family to continue to manage that family foundation. There's a lot of legwork and headache with it. Now, one of the fun things about creating a family foundation is that you get to select a very, very pretty logo. Right? Look at these. They're beautiful. They're, like, amazing. I included the LeBron James Family Foundation because I just think it's very cool. All of these, you know that a family sat down around a table and they thought, what is really the image that we want to put forward about our family, right? Now, here's a little secret that nobody probably mentioned to these families. You can do a logo, you can have the name foundation, and still have it be a donor-advised fund. Now, why would someone, instead of doing, and I have this as, I have this on paper for all of you because it's far too tiny up here. Why would someone want to replace their family foundation? There's a lot of status, there's a lot of pride in having a family foundation. Well, one of the trends is that more and more people are understanding that it's just plain easier. It's cheaper, it's faster to have a donor-advised fund. Now, if you are a member of a family that wishes to have a foundation, and it's really a legacy situation where the family is very involved and they're willing to commit the resources to managing the foundation, by all means, that is the right avenue. But many donors have found that they can accomplish the same level of visibility for their family, same amount of kudos. They can also acquire the same or potentially better tax benefits. And there's a lot of flexibility in what they can do. One of the perks is they're not filing statements at the end of the year to the IRS. They're not disclosing what they support. They're not having to cut the checks. They're not having to mail the checks. They're not having to do a lot of the mishigas, a lot of the day-to-day stuff. And that is a very, very, very desirable trend. I'll give you one example of a family that I've had the pleasure of working with. They're in the Tampa community. They set aside, they have two donor-advised funds. One of them, the two parents use in a pretty liquid fashion. They're in and out of it as they wish. Sometimes they'll support the Federation's annual campaign. They'll support other ventures around the community. But they also set up a secondary donor-advised fund, and they said, we only want to spend 5% of that one each year. So it kind of operates like an endowment, but they're designating their recommendation on that 5% each year. But we want our children, who at the time that they set it up, they were high school age, we want our children to meet together to make recommendations on this 5%. So I see some nodding heads around and some laughing because, why is it funny? Tell me why it's funny. Yes, exactly. And the parents are requiring these kids to get together and do it together. They could easily, each of the two kids, they could each individually send me an email saying, here's our recommendations for this year. No, they have to get together and do it. So parents are seeing some very, very interesting ways to use donor-advised funds right in their own family situation. They're passing on their values, and they're making it real for themselves. Now, why does this matter to all of you in this room? This is largely, so far, we've been talking about everything happening outside of the room, right? Donor-advised funds, they're a vehicle, they're a way to manage your tax benefits, et cetera, et cetera. But for you, as Federation fundraisers, as engagement folks, when you say to somebody, you know, I see that you're very charitable across the community. Have you ever thought about starting up a donor-advised fund? It could be easy for you. That's the extent of what you need to say. You can become a trusted resource in their world. But then, as the conversation progresses, you can become a partner where you're learning more and more about them through their giving, through their donor-advised fund. And you can even become an advisor where you find a project, you bring it to them. They may come to you and say, I'm thinking about funding this. I have some money away, socked away in my donor-advised fund. What do you think? To have a donor say to you, what do you think? It's an amazing moment in time. Now, I will leave you with this one thought. Knowledge is power. No ledge is power. Thank you all. That's it.
Okay, thank you. Okay, thanks, Emily. I'm going to try not to lean on the computer this time. Our next speaker is Fran Siegel.
Chief Investment Officer and Managing Director of Impact Assets, a nonprofit investment services firm that provides an impact investment asset management platform for investors seeking a blend of positive social and environmental outcomes. She's consulted to a range of purpose-driven companies, including National Geographic and Family Foundations. Fran is an adjunct professor at the Lloyd Grief Center for Entrepreneurial Studies and senior fellow at the Brittingham, did I say that right, Social Enterprise Lab, both at USC's Marshall School of Business. She serves on the G7 Social Impact Investment Task Force Working Group on Asset Allocation. So Joelle and Emily focused on grant making. Fran is going to focus on investing your philanthropic capital. Investment committees have traditionally shied away from impact investing because they believe that their obligation was to maximize investment returns. They had reason to be concerned. There have been legal impediments to impact investing. But that's changing. In September, the IRS announced that a private foundation will no longer be subject to the excise tax on what are termed jeopardizing investments if the foundation's managers have exercised ordinary business care and prudence in making an investment that furthers the foundation's charitable purposes, even if the expected rate of return is less than it is for other investments. So now that it's opened up for private foundations, it's much easier now for public charities to follow suit. Fran will demonstrate to you that you don't need to sacrifice investment returns in the pursuit of charitable goals. And I was reading in preparing for this, I came across an article in the Atlantic Magazine, and it talked about Al Gore, and I just want to share it with you. It was interesting to me. You probably know that since he left office in 2000, he wrote a number one international bestseller, An Inconvenient Truth. The movie version won 2 Oscars, and Gore shared the Nobel Peace Prize for his climate work. What you may not know, and what I didn't know, was that in 2004, he founded a private investment firm with David Blood. And everybody makes jokes about they should have called it Blood and Gore, but they did not. they called it Generation Investment Management. The Atlantic article describes the firm as, and I'm quoting, a demonstration of a new version of capitalism, one that will shift the incentives of financial and business operations to reduce the environmental, social, political, and long-term economic damage being caused by unsustainable commercial excesses. The article goes on to say that by applying an environmentally conscious model of sustainable investing, Gore and his partners have made more money than have most fund managers who are guided by a straight-ahead pursuit of profit in any environmental or social price. It signals a shift in the philanthropic model. For-profit and nonprofit motives are merging. And on this note, paraphrasing philanthropic strategist Bruce Dabosky just a little, Fran will be encouraging you to ask, where is my Federation's money spending the night? Fran.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to start with a question, and then we invite you and encourage you to step up to the mics to ask questions. And you should know that the session is being recorded and should be up on the JFNA website at some point. So if you have some private conversation, you probably don't want to speak into the mic to have that.
Or you could, right.
It's often said that it's harder to give charitable dollars than it is. It's hard to give them away responsibly than it is to raise the dollars. Giving Circle members, donor advisors, and social investors all must set priorities and make difficult decisions about allocating limited charitable resources. If Federation's annual campaigns have suffered to some extent because the new entrepreneurial generation of donors want to choose the individual charities to which their charitable dollars will be directed. To what extent have giving circles, donor advised funds, or impact investing increase the members' appreciation of communal giving and the process that Federation planning and allocations committees go through to establish community priorities? Anybody that wants to speak to that?
I'll speak to that. So it's probably not a surprise. I mean, giving circles really are like a Federation in a nutshell. Really, they're like putting money into a collective pot and then deciding together where it goes. And for people who, especially of the buzzword millennial generation, people who are less familiar with federations and less familiar with the model that federations have been working with for well over 100 years at this point. What really is really helpful about a giving circle, especially if it's housed within a federation, it's a tremendous opportunity to showcase the process that your federation uses to allocate its funds. It's kind of like a microcosm. It's almost like giving people like the inside track on how a federation's model works and plays out in a larger way. So in a way, it's especially if you have people who don't trust that model, are not interested in it, have never given to federation before, and really don't want to be a part of that, this is a way to say, like, hey, come on and see, like, what it's like on the inside over here. Like, see what this is like, and we're going to give you the control, and we're going to show you how this works. And in the end, it ends up building up a serious appreciation for our federation's processes and its expertise and the really important work it does around all the issue areas it addresses.
I'll jump in on one thing. So from the donor advised fund perspective, when, you know, that last slide that I, or one of the second to last slide, of the arrow of you becoming more of a trusted advisor. So when you have the opportunity to work with a donor who has a donor advised fund and you're having a higher level conversation, it offers for the professional, it offers a sense of connection. It takes the conversation up above the annual campaign, up above the needs of now, and you're kind of like an insider. And it offers an entree for those folks who you know, may not be understanding the allocations process or maybe a little bit out of touch with the idea of we only have limited resources, to offer some additional layered education. And I think the access of a donor advised fund strong relationship really gets you there.
I don't know, Fran, did you have anything? Okay. You've addressed this a little bit. This is for Emily. This question comes up frequently when I'm with endowment directors. Major money management firms have established charitable affiliates that sponsor donor advised funds. They used to be called the commercials. We refer to them now as the nationals. And some of the national firms like Fidelity and Schwab have seen rapid fire growth in recent years. How do you make the case for a donor to establish a donor advised fund at Top Foundation instead of one of the nationals or a secular community foundation?
So this comes up a lot in my world as well, as you would imagine. I do field calls from someone who says, oh, my guy at Schwab says that he's going to charge me 0.25%. What are you going to do for me? So one of the things that working with Top or with the Jewish Foundation that's in your particular community, there's two big driving forces. One is that our investing or money management, our process, is guided entirely by Jewish values. Schwab can never, ever, ever assure that. In my case, that means we have a very specific and unique policy on how we filter out or how we screen for anti-terror investment prevention. We follow a certain a piece of legislation that was passed in the state of Florida in 2007. It's called Protecting Florida's Investment Act. I like to say it keeps the money out of the hands of the bad guys. So we can assure our donors of that. The second thing, though, is in our situation, our foundation has a legal relationship with our local federations. As we mentioned at the top of our session, I'm with the Top Foundation, Tampa, Orlando, Pinellas. So if you don't know Florida, just think of it as the middle of the state. I work with three federations, three communities, and the way that we're structured, our fee structure actually passively financially supports each of those federations. And again, that's a selling point for those who are generally positive on federation. It's a way to give even just a little bit more over to the federation side.
Okay, thank you. Okay, Fran. We've encountered a lot of resistance to impact investing when we speak to investment committees, at least in the Federation world. is there anything, I mean, have you worked with nonprofits and had success in, I mean, how do you get success in persuading nonprofits to engage in impact investing?
So I think the impact investing and convincing your fiduciaries, your investment committee, your boards that it's an interesting thing to do just got a lot easier with this IRS ruling. Before, I think there was a lot of concern about jeopardizing investments, jeopardizing your charitable foundation status by investing with Impact First. And so I think this IRS ruling is key. The other thing is just helping your fiduciaries understand that this bifurcated model of investing the endowment over here or the donor advised fund corpus over here and making 5% grant payout over here, like I guarantee you this 95% is doing a major impact. And if you are investing inadvertently across purposes to your impact, you're probably doing net negative mission impact. And so I think that is something, that just the sheer girth. There was a three-part investigative piece of the Gates Foundation in 2007 where they, and this is maybe one of the benefits of having a donor advised fund, is a private foundation issues a 990 and they're public. And they're pretty interesting to read. You can figure out a lot about the grants, but also about how the investment is invested. And this investigative journalist in LA Times, followed the breadcrumbs and found that in the very countries that the Gates Foundation was giving, immunizing youth, they were also invested in industrial plants, and all those kids also had asthma. And so when you're bringing, the behemoth of the 95%. Against the 5%, it's a kind of a real issue. So I think that could be a great moment. And then also breaking down the walls between the program officers and the finance folks. So those are some ideas for foundations and also donor advised fund assets.
If a federation decided that they did want to start impact investing, I mean, how would they go about it? How do they set the metrics? Do they engage somebody from the outside? Can they do it from within?
It depends. I imagine that most of you that are affiliated with foundations have wealth advisors, and maybe even on the donor advised funds, the larger donor advised funds and our DAF have wealth advisors attached. And so part of this is educating your wealth advisor, and hopefully they can meet you where they are. And what we're seeing over time is that some clients are actually leaving their wealth advisors because they're not able to take this values-based journey with them. But there are all kinds of resources on our website designed for you, asset owners, and wealth advisors to help you get up the learning curve around impact investing and start the process. And then, of course, there are pure play consultants that can help you as well.
Thank you. Is there anybody in the audience who has a question?
Hi, I'm Carol Lear. I'm with the UJ Federation of New York in Westchester. I just wanted to let you know that we have two venture philanthropy funds running in Westchester. They're both women's funds. They're called Neshamot and Nedivot, and one has about 15 women, the other has about 8 women, and they invest $25,000 a year for 3 years. And it is a tremendous amount of work for the staff person who staffs the group because she is always, she has to find, besides working with the group of women, she has to find the organizations, the not-for-profits that they're interested in. She has to bring them to the table. She has to connect with them, learn all about them. And it's really a full-time job. So I just want to let you know that they exist. They're up and running and have been for probably five years now. Also, I just wanted to ask Fran, can you tell me about your company? Are you an investment, a wealth advisor, or you may have said it at the beginning, I just missed it.
Sure, I'm Chief Investment Officer at Impact Assets, and we primarily run a donor advised fund.
It's about $250 million, so small compared to Schwab and Fidelity, which I call utility DAFs. Yeah, they're the lowest cost, but they're also going to give you the fewest features. And one of the things that we do, and it sounds like, you know, some of the donor advised funds that you work with, is we specialize in impact investing. So when we have the investment choices for you to select from, they would be consistent with your charitable intent.
Right, but individuals have their own donor-advised funds under your umbrella.
Think of them as like separately managed charitable accounts.
Right.
And, you know, to your point, we have the smallest donor-advised fund that we have. Our minimum is $5,000, but we have donor-advised funds up to $30 million. That's a size that could command a family foundation, but for reasons that that Emily mentioned earlier, there's this trend toward donor-advised funds. So that's what we do primarily, and then we also have a bunch of issue briefs and field building and manager ideas that we give away for free as a way to help asset owners and wealth advisors get up the learning curve so that they can engage in impact investing.
Thank you.
I wanted to make a couple of comments about the donor advised fund.
Tracy, let me give you only because we're recording.
Can you all hear me?
We're recording,
so that's
the... Sorry. Okay, I'll trip over everybody.
Oh, okay.
So a couple of comments, and also I'm very interested in, many of us are connected with investment houses and getting them connected because we do raise this issue on an ongoing basis. So maybe there's some ideas for promoting and educating and maybe through the institute that JFNA does. In terms of the donor advised funds, one is also to add to the question about how do you relate it or how do you combat the thing, why don't I go over to Fidelity? And one is a playoff. What you were saying is that their mission of the investment houses is to make their stockholders rich. That is theirs. Ours is to build community. So every dollar that people pay for a fee goes back into the community. The other is the community relations component of it. So when folks make a contribution or make a recommendation for a distribution, it goes out on a Jewish check. So when the University of Arizona Foundation receives $750,000 through our doors, I'm Tracy Salkowitz with the Jewish Community Foundation of Southern Arizona, it's not a bunch of individual contributions, it's a huge impact showing the Jewish community support of our community. The other comment I wanted to make was a cautionary note. So many folks have donor advised funds and they want their children involved, and when they're setting up their endowment plans, they have their children be advisors. So one thing, in fact, we have a Hanukkah program where it's open up a donor advised fund for your kid. We preside, our minimum is $5,000. We provide a 20% match. So it's $4,000 from the parents or from the individual, and we provide $1,000. The cautionary note is actually we're going back to many of our fund holders who have their children as advisors because on their endowment funds. Because after their lifetime, the dysfunctionality that existed during their lifetime to get their children to work together and play nicely in the sandbox doesn't really happen. And it puts foundations in the role of being family mediators. So what we're actually encouraging is that folks move away from that model and in their endowment plans actually set up distributions to individual donor advised funds every year to each individual child. It's one thing if they want to play mediator during their lifetimes, Kol HaKavod, great, go for it. But afterwards, we really don't want to be in that role of playing professional mediator. So that's just a comment. And thank you, and I would love it if all of you would move to Tucson.
Thank you, Tracy. I just want to offer a follow-up on that. We had a similar situation unfold to the nightmarish situation that Tracy's kind of scratching at. Where in the Tampa community, a major community leader passed away. And he had four children. He was up in years, so his children already have children of their own. And he had named on his donor advised fund three of his four children. Who, and they all knew this. They knew this for years. It was not a big secret. And they were very, you know, they all had a normal human reaction about it, that that was a not a great way to go about it. But that, he was kind of that sort of a guy. And upon his passing, the four met. And in fact, just a month ago, the dust settled on this. And they decided to have one sibling be a spokesperson for the family in terms of the three recommenders that I had on file. And that one spokesperson said, you know, I'm representing my siblings, and we are recommending that that these distributions be made. And we were able to structure it so that four new funds were created, one for each of the adult children. And they live across the country. I have donor advised funds that are all over the place. And they were able to carry forward the torch. They each named them their own thing, some with the father's name, some without. And it was, at the end of the day, it was, yeah, there was one particular one without. and that is her preference, it's fine. But now their family legacy gets to live on. The checks go out. They're happy. They are honoring their father's spirit of philanthropy, but all of them get to participate. And that was, luckily, that was a really good outcome, but it can be quite a mess. And it did, from the time of his passing until last month, it's probably been 18 months that there are multiple psychological issues to deal with, and the grieving process and all of that. The dust settled and everybody is happy now.
This is the place for me to make a pitch for our multi-generational philanthropy training program. We make grants from the JFNA Unrestricted Domestic Endowment Fund. The program's been going on for, it's entering its sixth year now, so money will be available to some federations for training through 2164, which was a division of the Bronfman Philanthropies and now is independent. And anyway, you should look for more information on that, because it's better to work with the families while the matriarch and patriarch are still around than to try to have the conversation afterward.
Okay. I just had a quick question. My name's Ben Wax. I live here in DC for a fundraising software company. My question, Joelle, you were talking about the Matan Fund, and I just wanted to see if you had any insight on engaging, you know, millennial generation and getting them encouraged to be part of that giving circle. And I'm just trying to figure out what the demographic of the people and the individuals involved in the Matan Fund, if it's how many generations are interlocked. And
sure. So Matan Fund is, when it started 12 years ago, it was a bunch of guys who worked on Wall Street together, and they were in their 20s when they started this. And before it was ever professionalized and before it ever became a thing that it is now known to be, it was like 10 guys with beers on the couch, like, doing this. And then eventually they were dealing with assets that exceeded that level of professionalism and eventually brought in professional staff and a fiscal sponsor to manage this. They were all, like I said, they were all in their 20s at the time. Today, Natan's members range in age from probably 25 to 45. Some of the people who started it have been with it since. And it's thought of not as a multi-generational giving circle. It is primarily in that age range. And what we've seen with other giving circles, and particularly those being started outside of institutional settings, is that young people are taking this on and doing this with their friends. When, just to give you an example, when I had an open application period for this incubator program that I'm now running, where I have 38 participants who are running 38 new giving circles, of the people who applied as individuals, I'd say 75% of those applicants were under the age of 35. And half of them were men, which is worth saying, because it's, as we all know, for those of us who work in Jewish life, where are the guys? And a lot of people are asking, and it just so happened that when it came to people who were not applying to do this as part of institutional settings, that's where we found them.
Just a quick comment. We in Impact Investing see see it not as a silver bullet to engage the next generation, but we see it as really like a lean forward kind of thing. If any of you have been in foundation, multi-generational foundations or donor advised funds that have a wealth advisor, and the wealth advisor comes in and speaks quarterly about the performance of the endowment or annually, you have seen the young people's eyes glaze over. And around impact investing is something that they lean forward on, it's something that they want to engage on, and so that's another idea for multi-generational engagement.
Thank you.
I'm a baby boomer, and I know there's a lot of attention focused on next gens and younger generation. There's a lot of wealth that is concentrated in the hands of baby boomers, and I'm wondering whether any of the things that you're doing, you're finding there is an interest in. There's an organization, B3, that focuses on the Jewish community and baby boomers, and I think one of their findings was that the baby boomers are more like 30-year-olds in their interest than they are like the generation that preceded them. So I'm wondering, you know, what kind of interest you have found among baby boomers. Maybe it's a bad question.
I'm happy to speak to this. So giving circles, like I mentioned, are certainly appealing to millennials and young folks, but they are also very appealing to anybody who just wants to have meaningful conversations in a group of peers. And there are multi-generation giving circles. The Ahurai Fund in Philadelphia, for instance, is a multi-generation family giving circle. It's about, 20 families? 40 families who come together, and the baby boomer generation has three grant committees, and the children's generation, which ranges in age from 13 to 30, has their own grant committee. And they are actually responsible for giving a quarter of the funds away. It's like a way for families to engage their children in strategic philanthropy education, and that's how they roll. But other people start giving circles, especially, again, in my cohort, some of the individuals that applied are trying to start giving circles with other empty nesters in their communities and other, new mothers and new families. I mean, this is a way to build communities with or without the help of institutions to guide you. So really, it's just a model that can be used in any social setting and among any generation.
I would add that one of the things we know about baby boomers is, they want to do things their way. And, I mean, it's true of every generation, yes, but, you know, the boomers have a very special outlook on life, and they're part of this, you know, ginormous transfer of wealth that we're talking about. One of the things that I'm seeing when it comes to donors who are setting up a donor-advised fund or setting up a new fund for whatever reason, they're starting to look now and later. And donor-advised funds become a part of that conversation where they can take advantage of, you know, they may be having a tax event in their life because they've done well and they're selling a business, or maybe a parent has passed or something financial is happening, and they want to take a tax benefit at this time. But they're also starting to think about what happens next, what will be my legacy. And they're creating these very interesting hybrid situations where they keep money in a charitably liquid form in the donor advised fund, but then they also leave recommendation for years and years and years down the road how they want those monies to be effectuated into the community, whether it be to convert into a formalized endowment or to go to fund a children's fund or to do something else. They're thinking of donor advised funds in a now and later sense, which is pretty energizing because we are trying to elevate the conversation about legacy in our communities all over the place.
I'm answering a question that hasn't been asked, but just because we're in the last couple minutes, I would be remiss if I didn't say that there is such an opportunity for the Jewish community to step up around impact investing. Various Christian groups, Catholics, Quakers, Methodists, Lutherans are all kind of leading the charge. But this is a community that is so rooted in social and environmental justice issues, and it's also a wealthy community. And there is one resource, a specific resource that I can point you to. It's called the J-Lens Network. And Julie Hammerman started it. She's a wealth advisor. She's terrific. And She has a great website. It's a network of like-minded Jewish investors that are interested in investing with Jewish values in the United States and in Israel. And she has some great blog posts, and if any of you want to be put in touch with her, I'd be happy to be a conduit.
Okay, I think we just have a few more minutes left. Thank you. So I have one last question, unless there's one from the audience. Okay. I still might ask my last question.
Maybe you have a better question, I don't know. But,
no, I'm sure you're
My name is Adas Goldman. I'm a founder and CEO of an Israeli organization called Tarbut. And I have a question from the other side of who's asking for the money. So how is the change in the landscape of philanthropy, impact investment, giving circles, new foundations, how do you see that it changes the relationship with organizations, nonprofits, NGOs, in terms of how we work together? I think that's love to hear your perspective on that.
I definitely have some thoughts on this. So there are some giving circles that give away $100,000 a year, $1 million a year, and then there are giving circles that give away $1,000 a year. And that makes you wonder, how can you right-size that relationship with what an organization can provide? Are you really going to ask an organization to submit a grant? Probably not. On our website, and you can check it out if you go to amplifiergiving.org, we've created what's called a common grant application. This basically allows any organization or nonprofit of any size to create a profile and fill out that common grant application once so that it becomes available for every single giving circle that we work with to review. So that means that you don't have to be pinged every time as an organization that's doing important work out in your community to be overtaxed on how you apply for funding to giving circles. So that's one tool that we've created to address that. In general, when we talk to people, we talk about right-sizing your expectations when giving circles come together. Obviously, they're doing a lot more research and a lot more hands-on, thoughtful processing about what they're going to give to, and that sometimes may lead them to be in touch with an organization more than they would have been otherwise, or to potentially ask to volunteer and potentially feel like they can come forward and be like, I have all this expertise, organization, let me also give you this in addition to my donation. And all of these can potentially be good things if they're channeled well and if an organization knows how to channel that type of generosity. But I think in general, the benefit of being in a giving circle is that it causes people to get involved in organizations above and beyond just being a donor. And that's one of the wonderful outcomes, and actually the academic research proves it. So to the extent that we can lessen the burden on organizations to access all the good things that comes from giving circles, we're open to more ideas if you have them besides this common grant application, but it's something we're trying to always right-size people's expectations about what's possible.
Just quickly, donor advised funds make your job really, really difficult, just bottom line. You know, our foundation fills out the 990, but you're not going to get any information from that on any of the donors that you need to be reaching. So it comes back to, this is a real fundraising 101 sort of a little nugget for you. This is about people give to people, and it's about developing that personal relationship. I'm approached very, 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 very frequently from fine individuals who are out giving the rallying cry for their organizations, and I let them know that in our foundation, it's really developing a relationship with the donors. So whatever you can do, whether in a lot of ways I would suggest that you consider a donor advised fund for the fundraising perspective to be just like a checking account. Like, it doesn't matter where their dollars are going to come from when you're asking. You have to have that heart-to-heart conversation.
Okay, one last question, and we only have a couple minutes. Was there one, if you can, share with us an aha moment that you had, or a realization that you came to that was either transformative for you or transformative for a donor? That's, okay. If you can do that.
So I mentioned it in my presentation, but I literally have had, and this only happened like 3 times, I've had this happen like literally only 3 times, but they each were very special. A moment where a donor said to me, so I'm thinking about making this gift. What do you think? And it was just such a special little moment because they actually wanted to know what I thought about this organization or this project or what I had heard. And that's very unusual. And without the structure of having this conversation beyond an annual gift or beyond ongoing bits and pieces, philanthropy, that conversation had not happened. So that was a real aha for me.
A real aha for me is realizing how giving circles enable people to build stronger bonds with one another. And I'll just give you two examples that are near and dear to my heart. One of the giving circles we helped start is actually a group of women who are the wives of conservative rabbis who were students together at JTS and then took pulpits together, pulpits aside from each other all around the country. And this is the way that their wives, who'd become friends, decided to stay in touch, was to start a giving circle. And now they address issues of fertility and women's empowerment together. And like this is, and they do this virtually. And sometimes giving circles are a way for alumni of programs to stay in touch virtually and to continue to do the work that they learned together and espouse the values that they learned in their programs together. The DeRote Fellowship has one. The Bronfman Youth Fellowship has one for their alumni. It's really an incredibly powerful tool. So that for me is kind of one of the like, things about giving circles.
I also talked about my aha moment in my talk, and that is that the bifurcated model of maximizing wealth and then giving a tiny bit away, drips and drabs to philanthropy, that is a broken system. There's one of my favorite unattributed quotable quotes is that philanthropy is the runoff of a broken system. That's not against anything against philanthropy. It can be very effective, very impactful. But we're basically, it's a couple drops that sort of run off of the capitalist system. And so, going to maximize, whether it's Goldman Sachs or selling your business or whatever, and then going to a charity ball, like that is a broken system, and that you can leverage not just your money, but your time, your effort, your energy, your career, your relationships for good, to not be across purposes to your deeply held social and environmental convictions.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
And the speakers will be here for a little bit. If you have any questions, feel free to come up.
Great job, ladies. Great job, Gail.
Thank you. Thank you so much.